everyone. I'm Gary Null. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, the topic, war, conflict, and two unique individuals, one serving in the Israeli military, the other serving in the American military. Their common theme? They both acknowledge that what they have done was wrong, morally wrong. And we will play the first one. It is with Abby Martin on Empire Files. It's Israeli Army Vets expose. He said, "I was the terrorist." In the second part, we will be having on a man who said, "I was praised for saving imaginary lives, but 13 people I killed were real." This is the ex-drone operator. You will not hear this on any other program, because we don't want to face this reality, the actual circumstances, the context, the emotional challenges, the moral equation, all of which should be measured, should be considered, none of which is. When we go into conflict, we never look at the consequences. And if you doubt me, then ask, when was the last time anyone on the left, in the corporate left, I should say, challenged Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton for their war in Libya? And look at what Libya is today. Nope. We pride ourselves in promoting the justification for getting into conflict. We propagandize. In effect, we emotionally condition people to accept that whatever consequences come, they, the other, the enemy, deserve it. Now let's go to our first interview with Abby Martin and an Israeli army vet.
Administration in power, Israeli politicians have been celebrating this new opportunity, ramping up settlement projects. Some of these are even financed by Trump's own son-in-law, rumored to be the president's pick to broker so-called peace in the region.
Can I reveal, Jared, how long we've known you?
While these illegal settlements grow into Palestinian villages, some are built directly in the middle of thriving cultural centers, such as Hebron, one of the most hyper-militarized cities in the world. When I was in Hebron, I was shocked by how aggressively the police state imposed an apartheid system. All of the residents I talked to had horror stories of life under brutal occupation. Sometimes Israeli soldiers themselves dissent, even in the face of very severe repercussions. One of whom is Iran Afrati, who was stationed in Hebron during his time in the Israeli army. Since leaving the military after years as a combat soldier, Afrati has dedicated his life to documenting Israeli war crimes and fighting the apartheid system. Iran, you went from being a soldier in the IDF to being a very outspoken critic of both the occupation and continued takeover of Palestine. What made you go through such a profound transformation?
Well, it didn't something that happened immediately. Obviously, growing up in Israel, you know, you ask me what was my role in the military. I'm not sure that my role started with my enlisted. I think my role started when I was about 5 and I realized that my father is putting uniform and going out to Lebanon as a reserve soldier. That's the first time I felt that I'm a part of the military. The next time was in kindergarten when soldiers came in to tell us about the independent war just after the Holocaust Day Memorial. The next time will be when I was 16 and I will get my first draft letter. And in this draft letter, it will be written that I am a property of the military. This is something that every kid in Israel goes through. When you're getting into the military system, in the end, you're already so much embedded inside the military. The military is a part of your identity. It's as much you as you are Israeli or Jewish, for that matter, in Israel. And going into the military, I was expecting to be a manifestation of me, just in uniform, protecting my country, protecting my family. I grew up on hearing the stories from Auschwitz of my grandma. So my mother's side, my grandma and grandpa was the only survivors from their family, from the Holocaust. All of my grandma's family were killed in Auschwitz. The stories from my grandpa that was also the only survivor from his family from the Holocaust. And from the other side, my grandpa and grandma from my father's side grew up and hearing their stories about Jerusalem and what it is to grow up without freedom under the British mandate, For me, being in the military is to protect them and to make sure that our life will go on as in freedom and, you know, in good will. I went through 7 months of boot camp, and in the end of the 7 months, I found myself in Hebron. The only city that have a settlement in the middle of the city. So getting into the Hebron, one of the first things that I had to do was protect a Jewish holiday. And my job is to put on curfew 180,000 Palestinians. So settlers from throughout the West Bank and Israel, Jewish settlers, could come into Hebron and celebrate. So there's thousands and thousands of Israelis and Jewish settlers from across the West Bank coming to celebrate. And the only way to keep them protected is to make sure that no Palestinian is leaving his home. So literally one of my first tasks was to roam the streets and make sure Palestinians understand they're going into their home and they cannot leave until a second notice, until the next time we're coming in. And the first time was like a movie. You know, we birth into the city with our guns in our hands and our uniform and vest with grenades and six packs of ammunition. And we're just screaming curfew. And you see the chaos. You see the people just running from place to place, closing down their shops, running home. Because wherever you are when the curfew starts, this is where you're stuck. And you cannot go anywhere else. So you better be at home when we're starting to count the curfew. Now, the official orders to anyone who breaks curfew is shoot to kill. I never did that. I never met anyone who shoot to kill in this process of a curfew. But that was the orders, and they knew it pretty well. They knew what they need to do. This feeling of power at once came as a big confusion to me. I think I wasn't clear if I'm enjoying the power of controlling all of these people, or if I don't understand why kids look at me frightened. Why are they running away when I'm walking into the street? Before my service, I work as an educator. I love kids. So I think I was very confused on why a kid will find me scary. You know, I realize now in perspective, it got to do something with the fact that I have my boots on, my uniform, my helmet, my six packs of ammunition, my two hand grenades, my M16 in my hand. But I didn't realize that right. at the time. Right. And I really couldn't understand that. And I think in a very rapid pace, I realized that my job is actually to maintain an apartheid system. Very early on, I understood that the rights that the Jewish settlers have are not the rights that the Palestinians have. I understood that I cannot touch a Jewish settler if he is attacking a Palestinian. The best I can do is call a local police department to come handle it, like I would do at home in Jerusalem. So these Jewish settlers that live in Hebron are living under the same rights that I live in Jerusalem, but the Palestinian next to them, next house over, next building over, sometimes next apartment over, lives under my rule, my military rule. And I can do whatever I want with him. I can take his home as a temporary base for a few hours to a few days to a few weeks. I can decide that I'm arresting the people of the house and tying them up to defense of my base. If we will get an order to demolish their home or just lock their front door and don't let them out into the street their house is on, a street that only Jewish settlers can walk on and Palestinians cannot. So they have to walk through windows to yards into the other side, into the Kasbah of Hebron. I think realizing all of that in a very, very early stage in my service helped me understood that someone was lying to me along the way. I didn't feel like I'm protecting anyone. I didn't feel like I'm helping anyone feeling more safe. I feel like I'm terrorizing people. I feel like for the first time in my life, the boundaries between good and bad that I learned as a kid, and obviously I learned that I'm on the good side, was broken. I felt like I am the terrorist. And my job was literally to scare people so they cannot think about acting against the Israeli settlers or the Israeli military. That was actually our defined mission, to make sure that to instill fear in the hearts of Palestinians in Hebron. And that's exactly what we did.
I think Hebron is a really intense example of apartheid, obviously. Like you just said, the settlements in the middle of the city, it's extremely visible. You have the cage streets, the ghost town. It's horrifying. Why did you speak up, and why did you do what you did knowing that you would suffer such repercussions and potentially be banned from returning back to your country?
Well, growing up in Israel, like I said, I believed that I was the good guy. I mean, the story that all of us are being told all around the world is that the very clear difference between good and bad people are there. You learn about the Holocaust growing up. I saw my grandma screaming in the middle of the night, memories from Auschwitz in our mind, memories to our family. I knew that I am going to be a good human being. You know, in the age of 15, 16, I began being almost obsessed with trying to understand the Nazi side in the Holocaust. Not only to hear the stories of the victims, of the Jewish victims and any other victims from the Holocaust, but to try to understand how can a Nazi soldier get up in the morning, give his kids a kiss, his wife a hug, and go out to the camps and do his job. I just couldn't understand it. And when I got into the occupied territories, for the first time I understood how can there be a contradicting in inside yourself. As a human being, you could do your job and be a one person at home, be a loving, caring, you know, boyfriend or a son or a brother, and in the same time hold people under a regime so oppressed that people are dying not from only your bullets, but the amount of calories being entered into their territory, like in Gaza, from depression or sickness. This realization during my time as a soldier of me on the right side of history gave me this urge that something have to be done, something have to be spoken. Understanding that nothing is really changing from inside, that you have to step outside and start talking with the world about what's going on. And that's the only way you can live in a place, not only for Palestinians, but for me as well. You know, I don't want to live in an ethnocracy. I don't want to live in an only Jewish state that values a privileged Jewish life on every other life. This urges me to understand that I want my kids to grow up in a place when they don't have to oppress anyone, they don't have to be soldiers. I guess that's what pushed me to do what I'm doing.
Your humanity. Let's talk about your time after getting out of the military, and then you went through a series through the West Bank, interviewing soldiers, getting their testimony. Talk about some of your experiences there that cemented your belief system now and opened your mind a little bit more.
I think after I left the military, I was still under the impression that the things that I was going through were my personal experience. I understood that I do not believe in the things that I was doing. I understood that I was lied to. But I still didn't have the conviction that what we're doing is on a large scale. And leaving the military and starting interviewing soldiers really, I think, made me understand that there's a systematic oppression that is taking place in the occupied territories.
Eran, let's talk about Elor Azaria, the soldier who just got convicted of manslaughter. He executed an unarmed Palestinian man laying in the street, of course, in Hebron. On camera. Israel, of course, is touting this as accountability, right? Justice. What is your reaction to the verdict and, yeah, just your the case in general?
Well, I think the Elior Azaria case had to be understood by a few contexts. Mm-hmm. The first one is the context of Israeli military practice of executions and targeted killing and also confirming a kill, what Elior Azaria did on the Palestinian in Hebron. Are all practices that are alive in the military system, in the even police system or Mossad. It's illegal to continue doing execution. It's the middle of the previous decade in the 2000s. But then something very interesting started. I am in my previous role as a researcher into the Israel military. I was taking testimonies from many soldiers. And one of the soldiers I'm reaching to is a soldier from a semi-elite unit called, in Hebrew, Duvdevan, cherry in English. And he's telling me a story about how he's serving after this role from the, after this new rule from the Supreme Court has been mandated, and they cannot do targeting killing anymore. and how their officer is gathering the unit together and telling them, we're going to go out tonight to capture this person. He's highly dangerous. What we're going to do is we're going to come in 5 or 6 people's unit into their home in the middle of the night, break in quietly, go up to his bedroom, go into his bed, and point a gun into his head. Now, if he just wake up and surrender, we're taking him into the base. But if he scream, you shoot him in the head. If he lift his blanket, you shoot him in the head. If he lifts his hands or legs or trying to do any movement, you shoot him in the head. Now, because we understand as rational human beings that no human being can wake up in the middle of the night with a gun into his head and not scream or move, we understand these orders as an execution orders that bypass the Supreme Court order. And instead of saying we're going to execute this person, they're saying we're going to arrest this person, but if we feel there's some kind of danger, maybe he have a gun in his bed, maybe he will scream for help, we execute him. So execution is something that is very much alive. I continue to interview dozens of this Cherry unit that tells the same story about different cases, but the same exact practice in the occupied territories. They knew that this is what they're supposed to do. They knew that they were going into homes in the middle of the night to execute people. In October 2015, the latest intifada is starting, and even the official rules of not executing human beings are going off the window. From the prime minister, into ministers, into media people, everybody is talking about it from left to right, about you shoot to kill. If you see a girl with scissors next to you, you shoot to kill. Executions are very much alive in the Israeli military, the Israeli police, the Israeli discourse. People are calling for executions. People are calling for not only executions on, you know, what they call terrorist or resistant people, Palestinians that are running at you, but they're calling for revenge. And when Elior Azariah is doing what he does, he's doing it after he heard it, this specific order of executions every, what they call a terrorist, from every section of the Israeli society.
We wouldn't be talking about Elior Azariah if the execution wasn't on a film, let's be honest. I mean, like you said, this is commonplace, this is systematic, it's institutionalized. However, I do want to talk about how even before he was charged with manslaughter, it was a slap on the wrist at the beginning. I don't know if there was just international pressure that mounted at a certain point where they felt like they had to take the investigation forward. But even then, it was a very stark contrast between how right-wing Israelis reacted to just a house arrest verdict than, let's say, people hear when a police officer shoots and executes an unarmed black man. And usually you have protests in the street against the police trying to get accountability there. In Israel, it seemed like there was mass rallies in support of Elior Azariah.
You know, of course, it's not surprising. Israel is selling this idea of the soldiers are more important than anything. The soldiers are more important than the life of Palestinians. Not only the life of soldiers, the soldiers' identity, security, feelings are more important than a Palestinian life. The easiness, the comfortable of people going out to the street and defending every case of manslaughtering that was captured on tape, that is clear that its life is not in danger, you know, they contradict everything that we are being told. And yet, Israelis are saying in a very clear voice, not only that we don't believe in that, not only that we will oppress Palestinian and will act as much as, you know, do whatever we want, but in a very specific way saying, don't confuse us with the idea of moral or right or wrong. Whatever soldiers do in the occupied territories are right. Whatever we're doing is the correct thing.
I wanted you to talk specifically about the culture within the Israeli military that fosters anti-Arab sentiment and racism, essentially.
Yes, I think the system, you know, is not only inside the military. It's like I said before, that's actually what being an Israeli means. Being an Israeli, growing up in the Israeli educational departments, you understand that all the Arabs hates you, that they're actually, in a way, the continuation of the biblical Amalek or Hitler, or, you know, that everybody there want to throw you into the sea. This is what you're growing up with, and you really believe in that. I mean, going into the military, you're already going so full of hate and fear at the same time that you don't need much to be very aggressive, violent, and racist towards Palestinians. They see the Palestinian women and the Palestinian men as subhuman. The occupied territories are like an ex-territory when those human beings are not considered to be human beings. This is a process that you start in a very early age, being enforced inside your boot camp, and later on when you're going into your service, when you do not see human beings in front of you. Do not believe their sorrow, do not believe their smiles, do not believe their feelings. They are subhuman.
But they look just like you. I mean, there's so many Arab Jews. It's incredible. Yeah. Like yourself.
Yeah, and I think that the Arab Jews in Israel are probably the most tragic story in the entire story of Zionism after the Palestinians. You know, and it's not being talked enough, obviously, inside the Israeli society or in the world. The Mizrahi Jew, the Arab Jews that came around the years of 50 and onward into Israel, some came by choice, some came by force, but they didn't came to a country that was theirs. Came only about 2 years after Israel was already gave out most of the land into the European people. And they understood that they cannot hold the territory alone. They need more people on the ground to fight off Palestinians or Palestinian refugees if they will come back. And then they went off and brought most of the Arab Jews and put them in the most terrible places in Israel, on the borders with Egypt or Jordan or Lebanon and Syria. We put them at buffer zones to protect us from Palestinians. Some of them came in the civvies. The Zionist organization sends delegations into these Arab countries and called the Jews there to come into Israel, the Jewish homeland. Many of them didn't want to. Many of them, like in Iraq or Egypt, had a good life or in Morocco and wanted to stay. They didn't know what will be the destiny of this new country that understood that there's very much likely that a lot of wars will go on there. They felt protected in those countries and they said no. And the Zionist organization sent another delegations into some of these countries of people disguised as Arabs from those countries that terrorized those people to try to force them to come into Israel. They were born synagogues. We have testimonies today that talks about how they ran after people in the street and beat them down as so-called Arabs from Morocco, from Egypt or Iraq, trying to scare them. And immediately after that, more people from the Zionist movement would come and say, you see, the only safe place you have is Israel. You have to come now. And after they came, they were being sent into the most disgusting forms of settlement for the newcomers from those Arab countries, being sprayed from DDT with gas, trying to clean them up before they joining into the Ashkenazi, the European kids, to play with them. They were separated and segregated for years. That was not their country, and it's still not their country. And what they had to do to start to assimilate themselves inside this new country was to make sure that everybody understood that they're actually not Arabs. They look like Arabs, they talk Arabic, but they're not Arabs, they're Jewish. Because you can be an American Jew and you can be a European Jew, but you cannot be an Arab Jew in Israel. And they erase their identity. And they starting to form what we know today as the most extreme right in Israel. They are the extreme right because they have to solidify themselves as the most loyal citizens of the states.
You hear this as a cycle of violence, though. And every time I bring up, you know, especially being on the ground in the West Bank, visiting the Dawabsha family, mm-hmm. or who's left of it. Mm-hmm. You know, whenever you bring up these horrifying stories and accounts of terror on behalf of the Israeli settlers, a lot of people just say, what about the stabbing attacks? What about, you know, what about the terrorist attacks on behalf of Palestinians? And it's painted as a equal fight, as a cycle of violence. And then you have the truck attack that just happened in Jerusalem. As a former soldier, how do you view these attacks? How do you view the stabbings, especially when they are directed at soldiers?
Well, as an ex-soldier, I learned very personally that if you will not respect existence, you can expect resistance. And this is how people resist. Israel as a state like to use the idea that Palestinians only understand force or power. But the truth of the matter is that Israelis only understand power and force. Every other attempt from Palestinians to try to negotiate this situation in a diplomatic way was countered by more attacks, more oppression, and more occupation, more stealing of the land, more destroying of homes, more settlements being built. We decided to call going into the UN a diplomatic terrorism, and to go into the ICC, international terrorism. We basically describe every form of resistance as terrorism, because the sole idea of the occupation is not to be safe. The sole idea is to create an ethnically cleansed piece of land only for Jewish people, with Palestinian workers. Of course, some Palestinians can stay and do stuff for us, but this is our land. What people maybe don't understand is that Israel is creating the conditions into the situation of constantly having to protect yourself. Mm-hmm. We're creating this situation by oppressing millions of people into a phase where they have no other choice by resist. So many of these people lost a family member, had been to prison or lost someone in prison, and understood that nothing could be changed. Because the truth is that Israel do not hear the diplomacy. Israel do not hear the calls of Palestinians for equality. What we are seeing in Palestine is what a lot of people like to describe as the most complicated political situation of our time. It's probably the most simple political situation over time. It's a situation about equality.
It's amazing that you say that, Iran, because this is painted as the most complex, the most hard to solve. They've been fighting over there for thousands of years. You know, you hear these things, but really, it really does come down to basic equality and humanity. Mm-hmm. Would you say that you support the right of Palestinians to fight their occupiers?
Absolutely. I support the right of every human being under an oppressive military rule to resist this military rule by any means possible. I do not believe that Israel have a right to occupy millions of human beings without every decent human, simple, basic human rights for their name. And I do not believe that Israel would change on its own. At no point in history there was a state or a power that had the power to control over other human beings and benefit from it, and just decided to let go of this power by its own. It was always forced on them by the resistance of the people underneath them or the intervention of other forces around the world. And unfortunately, I do support the Palestinian right to resist in any way, I do not believe that their resistance is enough. I do believe that the rest of the world have to interfere in what's going on in Palestine. There's nothing else that we can do except for giving all the Palestinians equal rights and starting a new state, a new equality system for all human beings on the ground.
We're going to take a brief. I realize there are people in the audience who are either adamantly supportive of Israel and its policies or adamantly supportive of the Palestinian people and its efforts. It's important that we understand that the whole object of the exercise is to bring peace to both people, where Palestinians have a right to return and a quality of life and to live without fear of arrest, detainment, and completely take down the walls and allow industries to thrive, people to work, and have a sense of a purpose in their life other than hating the Jewish population. On the other side, all the Jewish people have a right to live in comfort and live with the idea that they're not going to be attacked. So both people deserve peace. But at some point, someone's going to have to become less rigid and start to understand, what is it like if I were living in the other person's shoes? How would that change or alter my perception? We're now going to hear a debate between two people, one supportive of Palestinian rights, one supportive of Israeli rights, Abby Martin moderating, to give you a perspective of what they're doing that you would agree with or disagree with. Now to the debate.
Let's start by giving each of you a minute to provide an opening statement on what you think is the primary cause of the current conflict between Israel and Palestine. Max, let's start with you.
There is no conflict between Israel and Palestine. Israel-Palestine is a single unitary state, and it is a conquest being carried out by the Jewish state in order to dispossess and ghettoize as many Palestinians as possible. It's been going on for 70 years. The population of the Gaza Strip are 80% refugees living in the second most overcrowded area on earth. They are the victims of this ongoing campaign of dispossession, and that's the root of their resistance. When they turn to violence, it is because of that 70-year legacy of dispossession. We need to see that and the siege, the ongoing siege, the eight-year-long siege of the Gaza Strip, which has de-developed this area deliberately as part of 70 years of dispossession, ghettoization, and expulsion in order to consolidate the ethnic purity of the Jewish state.
Morton?
Well, of course, this is utter nonsense. This is simply due to the Palestinian Arabs and the Arab world's refusal to allow and accept Jews living in their midst. 22% of Israel are Muslims and Christians. The Arabs were offered a state in 1937 on 95% of the rest of Palestine, in 1948 on essentially half. In 2000, and in 2008, they rejected statehood every single time, because the goal of the Arabs, unfortunately, is Israel's destruction. It is not a Palestinian state. In fact, the Charter of Hamas calls for the murder of every Jew. It is a Nazi-like document. Mahmoud Abbas's Fatah Charter, the Palestinian Authority Fatah Charter, in 10 clauses calls for Israel's destruction. This is the cause of the of this ongoing war, Arab war against Israel, is their refusal to accept a Palestinian Arab state. The cause of this latest battle is 3,000 missiles aimed into the population centers of Israel, attempting to murder as many Jews as possible. If there were no Hamas missiles, there'd be no Israeli retaliation. That's simply designed to protect the citizens of Israel.
Max, let's talk about that Hamas charter, which features that introductory quote by Ayman Hassan al-Banna: Israel will rise and will remain erect until Islam eliminates it. And as it had eliminated its predecessors, how can Israel negotiate with an organization that doesn't recognize its right to exist?
Well, that charter has been in publication for decades. Hamas has repeatedly offered to negotiate and has negotiated. They negotiated the Gilad Shalit prisoner swap. I'm not a spokesman for Hamas, and I'm not going to defend their political goals. What we're talking about here is a ghettoized population that's being completely decimated before our eyes, entire families being wiped out. And if you want to talk about charters, look at the Likud charter, which I presume Morton supports, which calls for the entire Jewish state control over all of the West Bank. It doesn't even recognize the existence of Palestinians. This charter has been carried out. It's being carried out before our eyes, unlike the Hamas charter. Morton mentioned rockets from Hamas. They have killed less than 13 people in the last decade. How many Palestinians ghettoized in the Gaza Strip have been slaughtered in this campaign of ghetto cleansing by the Israeli Air Force? How many? We're talking about over 1,300 in just the course of less than 2 weeks, and I doubt that Morton will condemn this or even put a limit on the amount of civilian casualties that he will be able to tolerate. We've seen this from no Jewish establishment leaders in the U.S., no moral limits, no rejection or condemnation of this slaughter we're witnessing before our eyes. My friend Rifat Al-Arir, who is the editor of Gaza Writes Back, this fantastic anthology of Gaza writers, who is a professor of literature in the Gaza Strip, who teaches Hebrew literature in the Gaza Strip, has had his brother and his brother-in-law, his best friend, killed for no reason. These were not people connected with Hamas militancy. These are just people trying to be at home. And I want to hear a rejection from Morton of this slaughter of a civilian population in a fashion that Jews endured under their own occupation.
And Morton, he brings up a point I just wanted to interject really quickly. Let's talk about that right to self-defense. We've seen that the Iron Dome has been successful at intercepting the majority of potentially deadly rockets. Do you feel and do you support this full-blown ground invasion and airstrikes on Gaza?
Of course, we condemn and are saddened by the death of any civilians, be they Arab or Jewish. But there'd be no civilians being killed in Gaza if Hamas would stop firing thousands of missiles against the civilian population in Israel. No Hamas missiles, no Israeli retaliation. And Hamas has told civilians to stay in their homes when Israel warns them to get out of their homes, out of schools and mosques where there are missiles stored. And Hamas tells them, stay there. If you're there, Israel will not attack. So Israel simply hits military installations where there are missiles and rocket launchers. Do you know that Gaza Arabs are paid a rent for rocket launchers that they rent out their living rooms to Hamas so rocket launchers can be in hundreds of homes of the Gaza Arabs? They have living rooms, they have dining rooms, they have kitchens, they have missile rooms where rocket launchers are there. So the Gaza civilians get paid rent for it. Israel has offered ceasefires. Stop laughing. Israel has offered many ceasefires. Hamas has violated every one of them. Well, this is the map. This is a picture of the emblem of the Palestinian Authority, a shape of all of Israel with an Arab keffiyeh, showing all of Israel as Palestine. Yasser Arafat, the arch terrorist, honored with in the middle of this emblem, and the Kalashnikov rifle promoting terrorism.
Morton,
this is who the Palestinian Authority is.
Morton, I just want to interject because really all I have seen is kind of these infographics and cartoons kind of backing up your point there, and I wanted to see Max's response to what you just said.
Well, this is the hysterical mishigas that we're hearing from the apartheid lobbyists in Washington from their air-conditioned offices who have no contact with the Palestinian civilian population that's being decimated before our eyes. Families in the Gaza Strip are having to choose which room they sit in to decide which part of the family will be destroyed in the event of an airstrike. We've seen the neighborhood of Shujaya wiped off the map, the area of Khan Yunis wiped off the map. The entire areas, 40% of the Gaza Strip has had to flee to UN shelters. 200,000 Palestinians are in UN shelters right now, and scabies is spreading through the population because the humanitarian crisis has gotten so extreme in the Gaza Strip. The Israeli, the most moral army in the world, has deliberately targeted Gaza's only electricity plants, and the ghetto cleansers from the outside have refused to restore electricity to the Gaza Strip. This is the dire situation. We're witnessing a one-sided slaughter, and all we're hearing is hysterical, discredited propaganda from another apartheid lobbyist in an air-conditioned office in our ancestral homeland of New York.
This is absolute rubbish. Absolute rubbish. If there were no Hamas missiles, there'd be no Israeli retaliation. The power plant that was hit, the hospital that was hit, were Hamas missiles that did not reach their targets and unfortunately hit hospitals and power plants.
There's no evidence.
Hamas's own missiles. The United Nations, don't interrupt me, I didn't interrupt you. The UN, United Nations themselves have acknowledged that this is Hamas missiles and Islamic Jihad missiles. If they stop the missiles, there'd be no more retaliation. The sermons by the Hamas-appointed imams, religious leaders, call that Muslims will exterminate all the Jews. Mohammed Deif, one of the chief of staffs of the Hamas, has said that killing Jews is worship that draws us closer to Allah. This is a Nazi-like terrorist regime, Hamas. Israel left Gaza completely. They threw out 9,000 Jews, all of their soldiers. And what did Hamas do? They created a terrorist state voted on by the Gaza Arabs themselves. They voted for the Hamas. They destroyed all the greenhouses that Israel left so they could have a real business, a real industry. They destroyed them all. And so even though this was all given to Hamas, to the Arabs, the Arabs' goal is Israel's destruction. no Hamas missiles, there'd be no Israeli retaliation. I wish that Mr. Blumenthal would start telling the truth and stop lying and lying and lying,
Martin,
defending a Nazi-like organization that calls for the murder of every Jew. That includes Max Blumenthal and his family.
Coming up, I'll feature the second half of the debate between Max Blumenthal and Morton Klein. Stay tuned.
I'm the resident, and I know words are powerful. Words like sheep, as in people who buy the crap our media sells us are acting like a bunch of sheep. Or words like greedy, as in our entire financial system is rigged by a bunch of greedy jerks. Or words like consumers, as in there's more to life than just being gluttonous consumers. I'm the resident, and I'm fighting idiocy one carefully chosen word at a time.
Welcome back to the show, and now more of the debate between Max Blumenthal, author of Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel, and Morton Klein, the president of the Zionist Organization of America. I've heard a lot of heated rhetoric also coming from the Israeli establishment, too. And considering that Gaza is completely closed off, that people have nowhere to go, don't you think that the way that this campaign is being waged amounts to collective punishment of innocent civilians?
As I said, these civilians voted in this terrorist, Nazi-like terrorist group. They rent out their living rooms for rocket launchers. Israel warns them to leave their homes. Where the rocket launchers are, leave the hospitals, leave the mosques where rocket launchers and missiles are. They're warned ahead of time. Egypt, they have an entire border aligned with Egypt. Egypt does not let anything to go in because they know Hamas is a terrorist regime that threatens Egypt themselves. Israel has let virtually everything go in except for missiles and armamentarium, but it goes in through, they receive it through the sea and through their tunnels. They've used the concrete not to build homes and mosques and hospitals. They've used the concrete that Israel's allowed into Gaza by building hundreds of tunnels from Gaza into Israel, designed to have terrorists come into Israel itself and murder and massacre thousands of Jews. The Hamas people who have been captured have acknowledged that in Rosh Hashanah they had planned a massacre of kibbutzim in Israel, hoping to murder hundreds, even thousands of Israeli Jews, simply to kill Jews. And Mr. Blumenthal defends Hamas, defends the sermons calling for the extermination of Jews, defends their charter that calls for the murder of every Jew, and Mr. Blumenthal should be ashamed of himself.
I don't think he's defending really the charter, but let's move over to Max, because you're saying that nothing's allowed. You're saying that everything's allowed and except things that can make missiles. Max, we know that that isn't true. Let's expand on that.
That's right. They allow medicines and all sorts of
chocolate, pasta, and aesthetics.
Morton, I'm talking Morton. Max is talking now. Remember, I didn't interrupt you, so don't interrupt me. I wanted to say, though, Morton, that I appreciate your statement of support for the brutal illegal coup regime of Egypt, which came into power under a military coup. We see the shared values between the Zionist Organization of America and the brutal dictator of Egypt. The Wafa Hospital was the only geriatric hospital in the Gaza Strip, and it was shelled and destroyed by Israeli forces, deliberately targeted. We saw people on life support systems carried out by nurses under fire. We saw elderly people on life support systems carried out, people who could have been your mother, Morton, if you had any humanity in you. And I know that if there were Jews in there, you would demonstrate some humanity for them, but you're not, because they're Palestinians. They're people you have denigrated as Nazis. You've denigrated an entire population as Nazis. My sympathy is with the people who are enduring this one-sided slaughter. The background for this slaughter, as you've pointed out, is the Gaza withdrawal. The Gaza withdrawal enabled the siege of the Gaza Strip, in which Israel banned everything from cardamom to cinnamon to size A2 paper. Size A2 paper was banned into the Gaza Strip. What were they going to do? Make terrorist paper airplanes? Give me a break. the Israeli administrators, according to documents subpoenaed from the Ministry of Defense by the Israeli human rights group Gisha, count the calories each resident of the Gaza Strip is able to receive. That is abominable, and that is the siege. Israel never left, and it's really important to point out that even though Morton and the Zionist Organization of America really represent the khaki shirt wing of the Israel lobby, his rhetoric sounds very much like the rhetoric that we've heard from President...
I want to focus some attention on another issue, and I found it interesting. It was in Eon magazine by Daniel DiNicola. And it was called, You Don't Have a Right to Believe Whatever You Want. You might find this interesting. He is a professor and chair of philosophy at Gettysburg College in Pennsylvania and the author of Understanding Ignorance, The Surprising Impact of What We Don't Know. And here's what he says. See whether or not you can align with this or challenge it. Do we have the right to believe whatever we want to believe? This supposed right is often claimed as the last resort of willful ignorance, the person who is cornered by evidence and mounting opinion and says, I believe climate change is a hoax, whatever anyone else says, and I have a right to believe it. But is that true? Is there such a right? We do recognize the right to know certain things. We have a right to know the conditions of my employment, the physician's diagnosis of my ailment, the grades I achieved at school, the name of my accuser, and the nature of the charges, and so on. But belief is not knowledge. Beliefs are factive. To believe is to take to be true. It would be absurd, the analytical philosopher G.M. Moore observed in the 1940s, to say, it's raining, but I don't believe that it's raining. Beliefs aspire to truth, but they do not entail it. Beliefs can be false, unwarranted by evidence or reasoning and consideration. They can also be morally repugnant. Among likely candidates, beliefs that are sexist, racist, or homophobic. The belief that proper upbringing of a child requires breaking the will of the child and severe corporal punishment. The belief that the elderly should routinely be euthanized. The belief that ethnic cleansing is a political solution, and so on. If we find these morally wrong, we condemn not only the way potential acts that spring from such beliefs, but the content of the belief itself, the act of believing it, and thus the believer. Such judgments can imply that believing is a voluntary act, but beliefs often more like states of mind or attitudes than decisive actions. Some beliefs, such as personal values, are not deliberately chosen. They are inherited from parents and acquired from peers, acquired inadvertently, inculcated by institutions and authorities, or assumed from heresy. For this reason, I think, it is not always the coming to hold this belief that is problematic. It is rather the sustaining of such beliefs, the refusal to disbelieve or discard them, that can be voluntary and ethically wrong. If the content of a belief is judged morally wrong, it is also thought to be false. The belief that one race is less than fully human is not only a morally repugnant racist tenet, it is also thought to be a false claim, though not by the believer. The falsity of a belief is a necessary but not sufficient condition for a belief to be morally wrong. Neither is the ugliness, the content, sufficient for a belief to be morally wrong. Alas, there are indeed morally repugnant truths, that it is not the believing that makes them so. The moral ugliness is embedded in the world, not in one's belief about the world. Who are you to tell me what to believe? Replies the zealot. It is a misguided challenge. It implies that certifying one's belief is a matter of someone's authority. It ignores the role of reality. Believing has what philosophers call a mind-to-world direction of fit. Our beliefs are intended to reflect the real world. And it is on this point that beliefs can go haywire. There are irresponsible beliefs. More precisely, there are beliefs that are acquired and retained in an irresponsible way. one might disregard evidence, accept gossip, rumor, or testimony from dubious sources, ignoring incoherence with one's other beliefs, embrace wishful thinking, or display a predilection for conspiracy theories. I don't mean to revert to the stern evidence of the 19th century mathematical philosopher William Clifford, who claimed, "It is wrong always everywhere and for anyone to believe anything upon insufficient evidence." Clifford was trying to prevent irresponsible overbelief, in which wishful thinking, blind faith, or sentiment, rather than evidence, stimulate or justify belief. This is too restrictive. In any complex society, one has to rely upon the testimony of reliable sources, expert judgment, and the best available evidence. Moreover, as the psychologist William James responded in 1896, some of our most important beliefs about the world and the human prospect must be formed without the possibility of sufficient evidence. In such circumstances, which are sometimes defined narrowly, sometimes more broadly, in James's writings, one's will to believe entitles us to choose the belief, to believe the alternative that projects a better life. In exploring the varieties of religious experience, James would remind us that the right to believe can establish a climate of religious tolerance. Those religions that define themselves by required beliefs or creeds have engaged in repression, torture, and countless wars against non-believers that can cease only with recognizing of a mutual right to believe. Yet even in this context, extremely intolerant beliefs cannot be tolerated. Rights have limits and carry responsibilities. In conclusion, unfortunately, many people today seem to take great license with the right to believe, flouting their responsibility. The willful ignorance and false knowledge that are commonly defended by the assertion, "I have a right to my belief," do not meet James's requirements. Consider those who believe that the lunar landings or Sandy Hook school shootings were unreal, government-created dramas, that Barack Obama is a Muslim, that the earth is flat, or that climate change is a hoax. In such cases, the right to believe is proclaimed as a negative right. That is, its intent is to foreclose dialogue, to deflect all challenges, to enjoin others from interfering with one's belief commitment. The mind is closed, not open for learning. They might be true believers, but they are not believers in the truth. And from my own perspective, I would say that that is the entire sum of the medical community. They have denied all the virtues and the proofs and the evidence and the testimony and even the good science on acupuncture, on energy medicine, on stress reduction, on yoga, on meditation, on raw food diets, on plant-based diets, everything that a counterculture movement has shown works over the last 50 years, they have completely rejected out of hand, taking into account that it is only the science-based medicine, pharmacological approaches to any illness that reflect their reality. These are true believers. And yet, I have seen time and again them sitting with their own kids, their own parents, their own siblings, their partners in my office. And in that moment, everything that they believed would help them, their orthodox mainstream medicine, failed them. And so this true believer, for all their other patients, made an exception when it came to themselves. And in that moment, they opened themselves up to what might be possible, but they would never allow that possibility and that openness because of their beliefs that, well, reality only begins when it's scientifically verified. And I say to them, "Friend, you cannot explain the nature of the life energy that allows you to live or be there after you're dead, and you didn't have a course in that at medical school. So ask yourself this, which comes first, reality or scientific verification of it?" And if they can't understand that, then they're not about to understand or implement the protocols that I would be sharing with them. So you see, we live with the idea that our beliefs are true. Some may be, more often than not, they must be challenged. and we must be open to surrender a belief that is found not to be true. If we could do that, we can grow, we can change, we can evolve, we can be conciliatory, we can understand, we can forgive, we can be honest. Thank you all for listening. I'm Gary Nall. Have a nice day.
Hey, what's happening?
Brother, what's up?
This is a big party, man.
Yeah, brother,
I can dig it.
Stop right on.
Mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know